Hello, and welcome to the Weekly Comic Spotlight on the Comic Book Page podcast. My name is John Mayo.
And I'm Bob Retall. In this episode, we'll be discussing recently released comics. One from DC, one from Marvel, and at least one other. As always, we'll keep major spoilers to a minimum, but we'll discuss general plot points and storylines of the comics we review.
The comics we're going to talk about this episode originally came out on July 22nd, 2009. And I don't know about you, Bob, but I have almost recovered from Comic-Con and the trip back.
Almost.
The trip back was a lot more brutal than I had expected. I went to... we were in Tucson. It was about dinner time. We'd had the big omelet breakfast thing at the Hilton before leaving, which we do every day of con. That's how I survive con. Guy at the gas lamp Hilton, excellent omelet chef. Great guy. But Kathleen wanted to do like Chipotle or something as we were driving through Tucson. I'm like, I've done Chipotle. I'm going to do Chipotle at work, something else. So I do Carl's Jr. Get the lettuce wrap burger, the fries. I'm good. I'm liking it. We stop over in Las Cruces, New Mexico for sleeping that night. I wake up, I don't know, like 7 a.m. And I'm thinking, I'm just not feeling that good. I don't feel bad, but I'm not feeling that good. And then, nature starts to call, so I start to answer that. And as I'm doing that, I'm thinking, damn it, I do feel bad. Next thing I know, the entire dinner I had the previous night flying out of me. And through a little of both ends, but primarily, being undigested in reverse or whatever. And I'm not a slow eater or particularly quick eater, but it usually takes me longer to eat a meal than the 30 or 60 seconds it took me to hurl it out. So that was a horrible way to wake up at the hotel that morning. Needless to say, I made my sister do all the driving through Texas that day. But my sides were aching for a couple of days after that and just still just kind of wiped out. But I'm glad that the glutening happened on the way back versus the way out. I just have this fear of, making a mistake during con, being in the middle of that packed convention floor, and going from not feeling well to throwing up in the span of, 60 seconds or whatever, and again, being trapped, like right outside the Warner booth or something stupid like that.
Well, I mean, that's the thing that it's hard to appreciate about what you go through because, there's a difference between choosing not to eat certain things. Certain people, like I eat a low-carb diet, mm-hmm. Some people are vegetarian, some people... choose to eat, this thing or that, but you, if you pick the wrong thing to eat, then, you're physically sick. So it's,
yeah,
it is a physical condition as opposed to a choice. So that makes it really tough.
Well, and I was really, really upset because it's like, I should have just eaten at the damn Chipotle, It's like, argh.
Well, I mean, it's funny because, you have a lettuce wrap burger, because I have those all the time at Carl's, and I mean, I don't even think about what kind of like gluten they might sneak into something like that.
Well, it is gluten free. The problem is contact issues, because
that's true. Because that's right. Whatever's on that grill or whatnot,
if it has come in contact with the bun or anything else with gluten, that's enough to do it to me. But I mean. I think it was last year Kathleen got sick as we were driving through, I think it was El Paso. Fortunately, I was driving at the time, so all I had to do was pull over so she could throw up. But, the year before, I think she got, wiped out during the convention, but, at the hotel, she just, collapsed there. But San Diego is such a physically grueling convention these days, even for healthy people. That, my goal is always just to survive it. And, I did this year. It was fun. It was good. I enjoyed it. But, actually, the one thing that happened this year, I don't know if I told you about Kathleen's hair incident. Did I mention that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. She was, John's sister has, like, ridiculously long hair. I mean, it goes, like, down to her, knees or something.
Almost.
Like that.
It's like Medusa-level hair from The Inhumans. I'm sitting there talking with her and a couple of friends. We're right outside the corner of the Image booth where they were selling, I think, the Invincible and Walking Dead hardcovers, maybe, or something. A guy cuts between her and the booth right behind her. Her hair gets caught on the guy's backpack, yanks her head about a foot to her right. And we're all sitting there talking. It's like, what the hell's going on? You know, fortunately, the guy at the booth, who I would like to publicly thank, stopped the guy, which gave me enough time to get my arm on him to make sure he didn't move any further. So Kathleen could, you know, detangle her braid from the guy's backpack. Now, if she'd had her hair loose, it's like, okay, I could see where that would be dangerous in this kind of crowd. But she puts this into a fairly tight braid, which, I mean, winds up being, I don't know, at least a silver dollar-ish, you know, thick, you know, rope kind of a braid, because she's got so much hair. But out of all the years she's gone to the convention, including a number where she'll have it loose for a while, this is the first time her hair has gotten caught like that and, you know, abused like that. But needless to say, that kind of shook her up quite a bit.
Well, yeah, you were telling me about that, but that's a big one.
So, and then I still haven't unpacked the comics and role-playing games and stuff I got from Comic-Con. I spent some money. How about you? How big was your haul at con? Did you have a good time?
Yeah, I had a good time. I mean, first year ever, I didn't buy a single back-issue comic at Comic-Con. I bought a lot of comics, and I got a lot of free comics and stuff, but I didn't go back issue bin diving for comics at all. I mean, I bought, you know, comics from lots of indie creators at their booth, and I got a Mayhem number one from the guy who was pimping that at the Image booth the one day, and, you know, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
But no back issue comics. That was a first. I got a lot of, you know, sketches and things like that, which I like more talking with the artists and writers now than going to the panels. I didn't go to that many panels this year. But there were some actually good things that came out of the panels. So one thing I saw afterwards on the internet about panels that I did go to, or did not go to, rather, was that Dark Horse is saying that they're going to revisit a lot of the Gold Key characters with Jim Shooter.
I was reading that too, yeah.
And DC has acquired the rights to do the Thunder Agents and not just read. I mean, they've done some archives reprinting the stories, but now they're going to be theoretically integrating them into the DC universe, kind of like the Red Circle characters. So that looked very interesting. A lot of good-looking stuff coming out from Radical.
Yeah, I was impressed by Radical's booth and Boom's booth. Both of those I thought were pretty good. Both yep. companies I think are ones to keep an eye on and doing some cool stuff.
I like Radical's booth a little more than the Boom one, just because it was a booth that you could walk physically into.
That's a good point. That's an excellent point.
Whereas the Boom booth was just kind of like tables around the edge. Sort of like the Image one, although the Image one had that little kind of aisle through the middle that you could go through.
I tell you, if I were Comic-Con, I would start cracking down on people who have excessive interior space of the booth, like the Boom one, the Image one, and there are a few others, just because they need more walking around space.
Yeah.
You know, if Boom
when you have signings. You know, like they had like Mark Waid signings and stuff, and all those people now have to stand in the aisles.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, if they were to have restructured the booth such at Boom to where, you know, some of that was, again, inside the booth and there was more kind of walking around and stuff, you wouldn't have just that outer perimeter of the tables for looking at their properties and stuff.
Right.
But.
Yeah, we're still going to do a San Diego recap episode, but given timing and everything, we just a little talking now because it'll be a while before we have a slot on our agenda to put it up, because we'll have the previews episode as well as the Mayo Report episodes, both the monthly comics one and the one with Chris Marshall on trades, going up, so there's not really going to be a open slot on the agenda for a Comic-Con full Comic-Con recap for probably a week and a half. So it's good to talk a little bit about it.
Well, it might even be a little longer than that because you were talking, we might do a preview spotlight interview. So
right.
It'll be middle of August before we have a Comic-Con thing up there, but that gives us a little time to go catch some of the news, because I found, you know, even being at Comic-Con, I probably found out about less of the news than people who were following Comic-Con via G4 or the web.
Yeah, that's true, because, you know, when you're at the con, you're doing the things that you're doing, and I wasn't spending a lot of time on the web because I was at con.
Yeah.
And I was talking to the people at con, and there's lots of stuff like that Dark Horse thing I talked about, like the Thunder Agents thing. I didn't find out about those things until I got back from con and I read about it on the web, because, you know, you can't go to every panel that there are. I mean, the comic book ones, you can't go to any, you know, every anything, and there's lots of news. And, you know, interestingly, the DC ones I kind of purposely didn't go to, because DC, for good or ill, you know, DC records all their panels pretty much, and they have them up on iTunes. So I've actually downloaded all the DC panels, and I'll listen to them. I'll try to listen to them before we do the Comic-Con recap episode, so that we can that way kind of catch discussions on at least that stuff.
Sounds good. If there are any juicy clips or whatever, pull those out and we can toss those in. Although a lot of people were on the internet at Comic-Con, Google provided Wi-Fi access to the convention center. That's how I was able to upload the panel so quickly, and by quickly I mean it only took about 3 hours or so to upload. Man, everybody seemed to have, you know, a notebook or, you know, some kind of, you know, computer gizmo trying to fight for that Wi-Fi access. It was insane.
Yeah, you gotta kind of draw a line there. You know, it's, there were so many people there who were quote unquote press that, or just bloggers or whatnot. It's like everywhere I went, there was someone sitting in a hallway with their laptop, you know, by every place that there was a plug, and they were, you know, blogging or uploading some kind of something.
Or Twittering or whatever,
about the con. And Twitter is, you know, getting a little out of hand. You know, it's like, I think there's like two kinds of Twitter. There's like the actual useful kind of Twitter where people put, you know, news items that are of value. And then there's the people who Twitter where, you know, it's like, I'm eating a sandwich now. Now I'm walking towards the bathroom. You know, it's like, I don't want to hear the latter kind of person's Twitter feed, you know, and it's like, other people have, you know, actually they restrict themselves to putting up only things of interest. But I was standing in line at the Kirkman panel to ask a question, and the guy in front of me was Twittering on his iPhone, you know, the whole time we were in line. You know, it's like, oh, they're asking this question now. I was like, okay.
Yeah.
And just, you know, you have your choice between, are you experiencing the moment and are you spending so much time blogging or Twittering about it that you're a reporter on your own life? You know, so I have kind of like mixed emotions about that, you know.
Well, I mean, that's part of why, you know, I wasn't really interested in doing all that many interviews and stuff, because there are so many people covering the convention, some of it doing in a live streaming kind of a format. So many people, including professional journalists, talking to all these creators and stuff, that I'd rather just go to the convention and enjoy it. You know, it's, you know, I think on the web you could probably find coverage of virtually everything that happened. Hell, I wouldn't be surprised if there's coverage of my sister's hair incident somewhere. But, you know, it's just, it's insane, and it really, really taxed the Wi-Fi bandwidth at times. But I was glad they had it. So, and we gave out, how many, you figure, 300-400 comics Thursday?
Yeah, at least, because I did some that were sets.
Mm-hmm.
And in reflection, I should have given out the sets to the people who were actually at the panel, but ended up giving out most of the sets to, well, either our listeners. I gave lots of comics to our listeners who are there, and then the rest to people who happen to be standing in that line of opportunity outside our room, because I didn't want to carry that three quarters of a short box that I had left over after we gave out comics to people in the panel.
Anyone who got a free comic and is listening to this episode, you know, anyone listening to this episode who hasn't done so before and is doing so because they got the free comics and stuff, please come to our forum, say hello, at least say thanks for the comics, let us know if you enjoyed them or not. The whole point of giving those out was to, you know, get comics in the hands of people who might enjoy them and to, you know, get a couple of more listeners. And we got about 204 new story pages to cover this episode, Bob, so you figure we ought to get started on that?
Yeah.
Now, just for reference, it's about three times the usual number of pages we cover. Normally it's around, what, 66? So I had a lot of reading to do for this episode last night. We will start off with DC as always. We're covering Final Crisis, Legion of Three Worlds, number 5. And for those who are curious, yes, the guest episodes covering Final Crisis, the actual miniseries itself, are not over. We will be continuing them. I chatted with Chris last night on that. He's editing one of them. He's going to be recording the other one, I think, this weekend. As soon as I get them, I will try to put them up. At this point, it's probably going to be mid to late August, just because of when we have openings in our schedule, because we do only three episodes a week. We try not to oversaturate our listeners with all of our great discussions. But final part of Legion of Three Worlds, number 5, I thought it was really good. I mean, overall, I have really enjoyed this series. Jeff Johns is an excellent writer. George Perez is a brilliant penciler. The only real complaint I have with this series was the delays between issues. You know, I didn't reread the previous four issues before reading this one, and I probably should have. And if we hadn't had, you know, a couple of hundred page, you know, comics and stuff to also go through for this episode, I might have. But I was also too lazy to go dig up the other issues, so I might not have.
Well, that's the thing. You know, it's like you have, in general, a dilemma between when you buy monthly books, and then there's the trade wait people who, you know, this isn't ever really an issue for them because they wait until a trade comes out, then they read the whole story in one part. Well, it's one thing when you have something comes out monthly, or, you know, maybe one issue is late. I mean, when did issue 1 of this come out?
That is a good question. Give me a minute and I will look that up.
Seems like it was at least a year ago, and there's just, it's a very dense story. There's lots of stuff, and, you know, when I read my comics, you know, they get read, they get put in a box when I'm done with them, and so I don't even know where easily I could find the last four issues, because it's not like they happened in the last 4 months. I'd be able to probably go to one place and find them if that's the case, but these were spread out over the course of about a year.
Well, it was August 20th of 2008 where the first issue came out.
Okay.
So, yeah, basically a year. I mean, that's just insane. I mean, the second issue came out on October 15th, so it was about 2 months, and then it was about almost 4 months with February 4th having the third issue, another 2 months with April 29th having this the fourth issue, and then about 3 months to this issue. So, I mean, it's unfortunate because it was such a good series, and, I mean, I certainly would not have wanted them to either substitute a writer or artist or something like that, but it really hampered the story momentum, and, you know, I nearly knocked it down a point on our rating scale because of that.
Well, the thing that I don't get, and maybe you can explain it to me, but I really don't have a solid understanding of why this needed to be a Final Crisis crossover.
I think it was a Final Crisis crossover because it is a crisis in the classic JLA-JSA sense. You've got, in this case, the teams are the Legion, and the Legion of different worlds, which, if you think about it, the JLA is kind of the JSA of that other, you know, for the different world. They're counterpart teams.
I don't disagree that it's a crisis. I don't understand why it's a final crisis crossover, because I'm not seeing any direct connection to the Final Crisis series.
Well, Superman got pulled out of, I think it was Final Crisis number 4, to go to this. And then, in theory, you know, it's a little unclear at the end, his timeline, Superman's timeline, of when he goes away right after the long-lived Legion, you know, bit with the cosmic treadmills, and when he shows up at Titan's Tower.
Yeah, but, I mean, that's kind of like a Red Sky crossover at best. I mean, it's not... There's no need for it to be directly tied in. I guess that's my point. I mean, this... What I'm trying to get at is this series pretty much stands on its own for someone who likes, you know, the Legion of Superheroes and this kind of stuff. And you can read this. You don't need to have read Final Crisis, in my opinion. You don't need to have liked Final Crisis.
No, I agree with that, yeah.
Or if you did like Final... I mean, it... Whether you did or didn't like Final Crisis, I think this series stands completely on its own and does not have any kind of tight connection in any way, shape, or form to the Final Crisis event.
Well, I think it does, but not in terms of needing to read Final Crisis to understand this. I think there are aspects of this that got pulled into Final Crisis. Specifically, the look at the Miracle Machine, which we don't actually see here, and a few things like that. But it's been long enough since I've read Final Crisis, for that matter, that I can't, you know, give you a laundry list of all the tie-ins and stuff like that. I think they were somewhat tangential, and I agree that this was a much better story. I mean, there were aspects of this that I just thought were really cool. You know, seeing Bart and Connor, you know, Kid Flash and the clone Superboy, you know, back in action, I thought was great. You know, the resolution and kind of the secret behind Time Trapper, I thought was brilliant. I mean, that was a really slick kind of way of handling that character and that character's backstory. You know, the two-page spread they had with all of the Legionnaires, where they even pull in, you know, the Legion of Super Pets, the contemporary age Legion, the Legion of Subs, you know, all that kind of stuff, I thought was great. You know, it's, I mean, to me, that's a classic George Perez kind of a splash panel. And it fit the story, you know, really well. You know, they did some cool twists to a couple of the characters, you know, with Black Witch, with Duplicate Damsel. This is something that I thought was a really tight, interesting story. I felt going into this that I'd kind of blurred some of the story details, and I think this will definitely read better in trade because of that. But I also think they really set up kind of that classic Legion really well for Adventure Comics and told a good story here. And, you know, particularly the way they defeated Superboy Prime, and that was just fun. You know, I liked the scene at Titan's Tower at the end. The only thing that left me a little cold on this was kind of the ending status quo for Superboy Prime. I mean, it was just a hair too metatextual for me and a little, frankly, a little snarky. But, you know, did this have to be Final Crisis? No, it was a marketing ploy. I mean, do you blame them for that? This could have easily just been, you know, Legion of Three Worlds. But because it was a crisis and they were doing Final Crisis, I can totally see where they tied them in. But, you know, 30 pages of story, I felt it justified the $3.99 cover price. I did find the DC Nation page kind of humorous, because Dan Didio was saying, well, earlier this month I was at MegaCon. I'm like, MegaCon? That was back in February or March. They couldn't even update the DC Nation page for this. Jeez.
Well, I mean, they did it because it was a George Perez.
I know, but
DC Nation. But you know, this was, that shows you when this was supposed to come out. I mean, I think when they do a mini series like this one, where they know it's going to take a while, for the issues. And, you know, George Perez, it just takes him some time to do something like this. It would have been nice, and they would have been able to do it had this not been a Final Crisis branded thing. It's just wait and don't solicit it until you have, you know, the first four issues in the can or something, you know. And then it would have come out and been a little easier to follow.
I would suggest that they wait till they have all the issues in the can, because, I mean, George Perez is one that does highly detailed work. Like you said, it takes him some time to do that, and it's worth the wait. But I'd rather not have that wait during the series. And with JLA Avengers, they got the first two or three issues done. He was working on the fourth before they started. He had issues with his wrist. There was the cover to issue three. There were delays, you know. So, I mean, yeah, if they can handle the production schedule such that they have it all in the can and it's going to come out like clockwork, sure, they should definitely do that. But, you know, I kind of sort of understand why they didn't in this case, but it also, you know, kind of annoyed me because, again, the delays and the release of the issues. But anyone who's a Legion fan, if you haven't been getting this, go pick this up. It's, I think, one of the best Legion stories we've had in ages, and I think we've had a lot of really good Legion stories over the last couple of years, too.
Yeah. And really, that complaint about the timing is a transitory problem. The only people who really get affected by it are fans in the moment who read the book monthly.
Yeah, exactly.
And now that it's done, it's no longer a problem because all the issues are out there. This is something that will get added to DC's backlist library and will exist as a trade forever, essentially. It's a really good story. And, you know, it's just too bad that the people who kind of pay the price for this kind of stuff are sort of the biggest fans who, you know, attempt to read it in a periodical basis as it's originally published, but that's not an ongoing problem for the story itself.
No, but I think it's going to be an ongoing problem for the publishers. Because those of us who are getting it in this original format are not only, you know, the hardcore fans, but we're literally the ones paying the cost of the creation of this content. And every time they have series with these delays, I think that makes some people less likely to get the next such series. It's like, well, I'll just wait for the trade. And it encourages that belief. And, you know, as hard as it would be for DC to stockpile the issues, then release the five issues and stuff, it would be even harder for them to stockpile the content and then go straight to trade. Because by releasing the five issues, they can then double dip with the trade or the hardcover. And this may go to hardcover first, who knows, you know. But, so the story delay, like you said, I agree, is totally transient and is no longer a problem for anyone who hasn't been reading so far. But I do have concerns about the long-term impact on the industry that titles continuing to have these delays is going to have.
Yeah, I think that ship has already sailed, though, really. I mean, it's...
Yeah, but
it's
more people get on board every day.
Yeah, that's true. And it's just like the publishers have trained a tremendous number of people. I don't know how many people that I talk to on the forums or via emails or at the con who pretty much get a lot of their comics in trade format.
And I totally understand why. This is another good reason why you should have. You know, so it's not just training, it's rewarding for doing that. And like you said, that ship has sailed, but if it continues to go down this path, that's why we're seeing lower sales on the comic side, we're not seeing higher sales on the trade side, and, you know, there's that Titanic iceberg kind of situation, I think, looming if we're not careful. But
right.
I gave this a 5. Like I said, I was tempted to give it a 4 because of the delay, but it's just such a well-done comic. I love the Legion. I loved having a number of the Teen Titans in here. Everything from seeing, you know, the various Legionnaires on that two-page splash that I haven't seen in ages. It was great. So I wish they would have taken a few more characters at the end and kind of left them available for the Legion they're going to go with. specifically some of the more unique characters that didn't have counterparts. You know, Thunder, maybe Gear, a couple like that. But again, overall, great stuff. I'm looking forward to the Legion stuff happening in Adventure Comics. So, 5 out of 5 for me.
So, I mean, I gave it the same. I'm not going to penalize the story itself because of the shipping schedule, which was really the only, you know, real problem that I had with it. But the story is the story. And the story was really good. The art was really good. Highly recommended. I mean, at this point, you know, if whoever's been reading it as it went along know that already themselves, and anyone who has not picked it up, it's not going to be an issue for them because they can get the whole thing at once.
Yeah. Shall we move on to our Marvel book?
Amazing Spider-Man number 600.
This had 98 story pages. This thing was huge. It goes up to 102 if you count those fake covers or whatever. Not only did this have a ton of content, it had a 61-page main story. That right there is the equivalent of almost what we usually cover every week on the Weekly Comic Spotlight. And even at $4.99, I thought just that main story was worth the price of admission. I thought it was great. I'm not too keen on the changes to Doc Ock, but man, overall, this comic, I was really pleased with, really impressed. You know, it was a good story. I like where they're going with some of the characters. Again, not so crazy about the Doc Ock stuff, but the interplay between the Parkers, the Jamesons, the other characters they've got in here, it was all fun. Guest appearance by the Fantastic Four was kind of cool. The backup features, I ran hot and cold on. I thought My Brother's Son by Mark Waid, excellent example of just how and why Mark Waid is a brilliant writer. I mean, the ending of the story was kind of telegraphed, but to me that was the point of the story, is that Uncle Ben didn't really see the end of the story coming until he got there, kind of thing. I mean, I love that story, and it was only 5 pages. And I mean, Mark Waid packed a lot of heart and soul into that story. Some of the other ones, you know, If I Were Spider-Man, the fight at the museum, which I thought was fun. I mean, the I Was Spider-Man, it's like, eh. That one was too much of almost of a deconstruction of why it would suck to be Spider-Man. And it was on the nose, it was kind of okay, but not something that I think, oh wow, people gotta read. The Violent Visions at the back, setting up a future storyline, okay, that's cool. Nothing felt like a waste of space, but to me it was the main story and the My Brother's Son backup that really, you know, made this a great comic for me.
In a dissenting opinion, I actually liked the If I Was Spider-Man story. I think it was, you know, just cool to see the little kids, you know, thinking a little deeper about, you know, the fact that it's not all just, you know, fun and games to be a superhero or any kind of job, really. I mean, they were kind of like thinking about, you know, some of the back matter that goes into things. So I thought it was interesting. And it's not something I think about myself all the time. So I enjoyed that story. The Stan Lee one, you know, was like, okay, Stan, you know, came out and did a story. It was kind of interesting. I liked that one just because it kind of like, you know, touched upon a lot of the different changes to the status quo.
Yeah, he covered the various Spider-Man oddities fairly well.
Yeah. But all in all, it was really well done. As far as the issue 600 goes, it's probably the best one that Marvel's done so far. And to the Incredible Hulk's detriment, coming out the same exact week.
Yeah.
This was so much better than the Incredible Hulk one. It was not even amusing.
Well, and we'll get to the Hulk in a minute, but the big difference for me between the two was they had Hulk Gray number 1 reprinted in Hulk 600. So it's 22 pages, which, you know, frankly, I didn't read because I'd read it way back when. So that reduced its page count to 56 total story pages between the main feature and the backup for all the Hulk stuff. The 61 pages in the main feature for Spider-Man 600, was more than that. Plus, you get all this backup stuff.
Yeah.
So, I mean, they pulled out all the stops. The only thing they didn't do in Spider-Man 600 that I wish they had, just for the sake of having done it, was the cover gallery.
Yeah, you know, I think that it would have been a better choice to use the pages that they used for the joke covers.
Yeah.
To run a cover gallery of the 600 issues of Spider-Man, because that is something that I liked in the... and they had that in the Captain America one, too, right?
Yeah, and the Thor one.
And the Thor one, and they had it in the Hulk one. One thing else I found in the Hulk one is they had a lot more house ads in the Hulk one.
I didn't really... notice,
yeah, we'll
but
talk
yeah.
about that when we get to it. But I mean, I really like the fact that, you know, those cover galleries. I mean, you gotta like get a magnifying glass out for some of them.
Yeah, I complain about how small the covers are, but yeah, it's nice to have them though. I mean, this, I mean, like the fake cover they had of the Shame of the Spider Son, I think is funny. But then again, we're familiar with the early Super Sons stories that weren't even reprinted in the saga of the Super Sons. You know, and this is a spoof of one of those. But those were pages that, while I didn't mind them being there, didn't do anything for me.
Right.
So, and overall, they knocked this one out of the park. You know, roughly 100 pages of story. Excellent main story. Good backup features. The one backup feature that I was a little disappointed in the editors with was the blessing with Aunt May, basically, you know, at the grave, you know, trying to get, you know, Uncle Ben's permission, if you will. Which, I liked the story, but it felt redundant with aspects of the main story. And I felt that the editors really should have kind of caught that and done something about that. I don't know what they would have done about it, but you know what I mean.
Yeah, I don't know what they would have done other than take it out and use that space for a cover gallery.
Tweak the main story a little.
Yeah.
You know, get rid of just that one scene where she's at the graveyard or something. So, but for me, this was another 5 out of 5. You know, it was huge. It was a great read. I'm loving what they're doing with Spider-Man these days. And I felt this was a worthy landmark kind of issue.
Yeah, it was certainly well worth the money, and anyone who likes Spider-Man should be seeking this one out and picking it up. It's all in here, and you know, I think a lot of the stuff about Spider-Man that makes Spider-Man fun with the supporting cast is in here. You got action, you got fighting, you got it all. So 102 pages, $4.99. You're talking about 5 cents a page, and well worth it.
So what rating?
I gave it a 5.
Okay. Just making sure. Shall we move on to our other book for the week before we get to our bonus one? That other book is Cyberforce Hunter Killer number 1. Now, I have read most of the Cyberforce stuff in the past, but don't really consider it kind of a top-notch property. I don't think I've read any of the Hunter Killer stuff. I got this mainly because Mark Waid was writing it, and Mark Waid's a really, 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 really good writer. And this is another good example of that. I thought this was a really good introduction to both Cyberforce and Hunter Killer. The story gets up to speed, hits an interesting turning point at the end of the issue, and frankly, got me interested in maybe tracking down some of the back issues of Hunter Killer.
Yeah, which you should, because Mark Waid wrote those. So,
I mean, to me, you can't get much more successful than that. Now, I had... the art is a style I'm not overly fond of. It worked fine. It didn't really turn me off. But that would be about the only reason I would give this a 4 instead of a 5. Overall, as far as the first issue goes, incredibly successful, in my opinion.
This is the same art. That's interesting, because you liked this art when it was in...
Madame Mirage?
Madame Mirage.
There was something about it on a couple of the pages where it felt a little more unfinished here, and a little rougher.
And it's kind of a different art style. I kind of like it. It's not. It looks distinct from other art. Although I can see your point that on some pages it looks a little rougher than others. Like for instance, the first two pages with the jet ad.
Mm-hmm. Those are nice. I love those.
Those are a very finished look. But then the very next page, it's got that kind of like rough kind of feel to it.
Mm-hmm. And some of it may also be the coloring, because I think in a few cases there were some odd color choices. You know, why is this cave so purpley on that fourth page or whatever? And again, it's not bad art. It was just a style that didn't totally click with me.
I found it interesting that the they built a whole website on the back cover. It says www.getthejet.com. So I went there. I went to www.getthejet.com. And they got a whole website. And it's like got like, you know, like this is a real product. The Jet, for our listeners, is a little cell phone replacement. It's like kind of like a little earpiece that's your all-in-one communicator, kind of like getting like Star Trek level communicator. It goes in your ear. It runs off of your body's heat / bioelectric field, so you never need to put any kind of batteries in it. It's got like a little video projector in it, so it can like shoot out a little holographic video screen of, you know, like what you want to look at, movies, TV, the internet. It's always connected to the World Wide Web, but the dark part of it is that it's got, you know, kind of hidden software in it that allows them to track you, and it's also got push technology where it's going to be pushing information from you back to these guys, as opposed to just you pulling information off of the internet. If you go and do check out the Get the Jet website, there's a little menu bar across the top, and at the very right of it, there's a couple of slashes that don't have a choice on it, and if you click on those, it brings you into kind of like a hidden part of the website where there's an email thread between some of the developers of the Jet, and ultimately it gets down to a point where, you know, one of the scientists objects to some of that stuff, and they essentially have him taken care of. You know, you get like a kind of corporate string of emails about that. So that's kind of interesting. It's just a little bit of extra content for people who might check this out. Now, they were actually giving copies of this away at the con. I picked up, because I had an extra copy of this that I picked up probably at the Top Cow booth. I know I didn't buy it, and it was in my pile of stuff that I had when I got home, so I picked it up somewhere along the way. I gave my extra copy to my niece, but it was a good book. I liked it.
Again, I enjoyed it, but I'm glad you mentioned the Get the Jet stuff, because I had seen those ads in other, I guess, Top Cow books, and it's like, what the heck is this? And I thought they were really kind of lame ads and didn't make sense, and yeah, it ties into this, and that's an interesting marketing ploy, but I'm going to go with kind of questioning how successful it was, because even after reading this issue, I didn't put two and two together. So,
well, I'll tell you what, if they didn't have the first two pages of the story, I wouldn't have put it together either. But the first two pages of the story were essentially talking about the Jet and everything, and, you know, because I had seen those other ads, you know, I kind of like, oh, okay. And then when I closed the book and I saw the website on the back, and I have seen that ad in other places, but you don't get the connection.
Well, the ad I'd seen was a different one that had kind of what they have, the girl they have at the top of the main page for GetTheJet.com. So a different ad, which is, I think, a little more obvious about the Get the Jet thing than that one was. So I didn't even notice it on the back page when I closed the comic. But interesting. And, you know, kudos for them to putting together a website and trying to do some of that kind of marketing and stuff. You know, again, I am curious how effective it is in this case, because going from the comic, I didn't notice the website. For the website, you know, I noticed the ads but never bothered to go to it, so...
I didn't look at it from a standpoint of, well, you know, if I looked at it from that standpoint, I'd say it's completely unsuccessful. I looked at it from the standpoint that it was just a cool extra Easter egg-y kind of thing to add to this comic and this comic story, as opposed to a marketing tool that are actually going to drive people to the property, because it's not doing that.
Yeah, and for coolness, it works.
Yeah. I looked at it exclusively from the coolness factor, because even when you go to the website, I mean, they're totally playing it straight, like there actually is this advanced research technology company. You know, it's like they got the fake press releases running back 10 years, and it's like totally playing it straight like it's a real product. And, you know, and nowhere in there does it even say, hey, go check out Cyberforce Hunter Killer or anything like that. So there's no marketing in it at all.
Yeah.
It's really kind of like cool ancillary material to the story.
And again, that kind of stuff, I applaud them for doing, you know, going that extra effort and stuff. But I question, not just on the marketing side, but how many people are even going to go to this thing and get this extra material, you know?
Well, our listeners will now.
Thanks to you, they will.
But I liked it. And, you know, another thing I'll mention in here, I mean, it didn't count in the story pages, but the darkness slash pit preview. That one looked actually interesting. I never read the pit very much, but the art in it was really pretty good.
I read the pit when it was coming out. That was Dale Keown, right?
Right.
Is he doing the art on this? Let me flip back to there.
Doesn't say.
Yeah, Paul Jenkins, Dale Keown.
Oh, there it is, Paul Jenkins.
Because it's nice art. It's an interesting character. It's kind of a Hulk-ish character. I'll probably skip on this. That ending double page splash or whatever. It's like, you know, it's a little more, you know.
Yeah, zombies.
Zombie.
I like zombies.
Yeah. Me not.
I'll
so
probably
much.
Pick it up. I'll probably pick it up because.
Yeah. And I think it'll be good though.
And that's the thing. I think it's effective, and this is kind of the dilemma to putting any preview out. I mean, you're going to, and it's a good thing, I think. I mean, you're showing someone exactly what they're going to be getting, and people who like that sort of thing are going to be drawn to it. People who don't like that sort of thing are going to now know to avoid it.
Yeah.
And I applaud the fact that they... that they do that kind of thing. I remember when they were running all those Nick Fury and the Howling Commandos previews in Marvel, and it's like, I looked at that and I was like, well, I might have been getting this before, but now that I've seen the preview, I'm definitely not going to get it. You know, but in this case, I think I'll be checking this one out.
So what rating do you give Cyberforce?
I gave it a 4. Yeah. I enjoyed it a lot. It didn't have that little extra oomph that I would have needed to get it to a 5, but I thoroughly enjoyed it. It was a good story and good art. And again, I kind of applauded the extra little effort for the cool extra stuff that they had.
Well, let's move on to our bonus book of the week, and that's Incredible Hulk 600. This had a main story, a couple of backup stories, and a reprint. It had a total of 78 story pages, but only 56 were new material because of the 22 pages of Hulk Gray number 1 that were reprinted. And like I said before, since I had already read that way back when, I didn't bother to reread it, because by this point last night I had already read like 200 pages almost. So it's like I was getting a little tired. I liked the main story, but it was good but not brilliant, and it felt lightweight, particularly compared to that Spider-Man main story. You know, there was nothing really wrong with it, but it was operating at a different level, I guess. You know, you get a lot of big splash pagey type stuff, and It's more of a action-adventure roller coaster ride than a engrossing kind of a story. I think people are going to eat this up. I think it'll sell really well. People have been loving the Hulk stuff, you know, and I can kind of understand that. But to me, where this sort of failed was at the end of the story, things kind of split into a number of different directions, and it wasn't immediately clear to me which story was going to follow up in which Hulk title, or where some of the stories in those upcoming Hulk family titles, where they're coming out of. Because at the end of this, they have a couple of pages of just covers of here's what's coming up in Hercules and Incredible Hulk, Son of Hulk.
That's what I was talking about before. At that point, they've got 8 pages in a row of house ads.
Ah, okay.
For the books. I mean, it's like you got Hulk number 13, Incredible Hulk number 601, Hulk 14, which I guess is a 2-page one.
Well, it's Red Hulk versus X-Force. I couldn't tell if that was a different... No, I guess that's just...
I think that's just what's in Hulk 14, and yeah. It looks like a wraparound cover. And then, you know, you got Hercules 132 and 133, you got Son of Hulk number 13. I guess you don't really count the Ultimate Avengers ad that came right after it, but it's just like,
well, it's
okay.
It's funny, because to me, the Ultimate Avengers, I would consider that definitely a house ad. And I'm not going to say these others aren't, but to me, they were kind of the next issue page. And it's just they had so many damn next issues to be promoting or whatever. But then I look at some of these, it's like I'm unclear looking at that Hulk 13 and Incredible Hulk 601. It looks like Bruce Banner in both of them. You know, I'm like, what's going on? What's next? And, you know, it didn't get... The main story nor these pages really got me overly excited about these upcoming issues. And to me, that's something of a failure of this issue.
Well, the one thing that bugged me about this was they've been, I thought, and maybe this is an unfair statement, but I could have sworn that they were, at least the internet was talking about the fact that you're going to finally find out who the Red Hulk is in this one. And of course you don't.
I think they'd been saying that too.
So I'm kind of like, you know, it's like, how long are they going to string that along? You know, it's like,
I don't know, but you know, sooner or later they probably ought to tell us. I don't think they will, but who knows?
I mean, there were certainly cool elements to the story, but and maybe because I haven't been reading every issue of the Hulk up to this, I didn't quite understand where the Red Hulk gets this ability to siphon the energy out of regular Hulk.
That, I think they had established, that he is able to absorb at least gamma radiation, if not other radiation, but I'd be hard-pressed to recall exactly which issue they established that in. That I don't think was new to this. They say secrets revealed. It doesn't actually... who is the Red Hulk? It asks that as a question. I'm looking at the solicitation now. Because I, too, was thinking we would be told who it was. And it implies that it would be revealed, but it doesn't actually say it would be revealed.
Yeah, well, I guess you know, we still have the question. Who is the Red Hulk? That's valid. You'll come out of this issue saying, who is the Red Hulk?
So I thought the backup features, the Hulk of many colors, was a bit too whimsical for my taste. It was not bad, but pointless. The She-Hulk backup feature felt kind of like an epilogue for the new all-new Savage She-Hulk miniseries that finished the same week. And it wasn't bad, but it seems to be positioning a character in the Marvel Universe that doesn't really need to be in the Marvel Universe. You know what I mean? How many She-Hulks do we need? How many Hulks do we need? That's the basic question I have.
Well, and we need as many as people will buy.
I was going to say.
Apparently the answer.
Well, their answer seems to be one more. Continually one more. They did the cover feature here. Again, I like it, but like we mentioned before, you need that electron microscope to see some of these. I didn't think this was a bad comic. I do think it was a bad Milestone 600 comic. And for me, it was nowhere near as impressive as Spider-Man 600, Thor 600. I gave this a 3. I felt it was okay.
I gave it a 3 also. You know, and that's the thing. I felt the same way about Captain America.
Yeah.
You know, when we talked about that. I mean, I gave it a better rating because it was a better overall story, but it wasn't a good 600 Milestone supersize event. You know, and that's what I felt about it. You know, it's like this one, the story was, you know, average. It left as many questions unanswered as it answered. You didn't really get a lot out of it. And at the end of the day, it just felt like it pretty much could have been just another issue of the Hulk, because the backup features or the, you know, extra stuff that they threw in here was not that compelling to me.
Or really related to the main story in any way, shape, or form. Yeah, it was extraneous material.
Yeah, it was just like, here, let's stuff this extra stuff in here to pad out the page count.
Where I felt all of the backup features, even the ones that I didn't care all that much for, because I didn't hate any of the backup features in the Spider-Man one, but I felt all of them thematically tied into the main story in some way, shape, or form. You know, Uncle Ben was such a main aspect of that main story, even though he wasn't in it, that both the story with Aunt May that was a little redundant, you know, going to the graveyard made perfect sense. The story with Peter and Uncle Ben, you know, that flashback thing worked beautifully. And even kind of the, you know, all the changes Spider-Man's gone through over the years, again, harkens back to just how far Spider-Man's come, which I thought was thematically a major part of that opening main story. So all of that worked as a good package, whereas with this Hulk, it's like, well, we're going to do 100 pages. What can we throw in there? You know, let's throw a couple more pages of the She-Hulk thing. Let's do a reprint. Oh, we'll take Hulk Gray. And oh, crap, we've got a few more pages. We'll put covers of upcoming issues. You know, it seemed like a by-the-numbers kind of approach and not a driven or you know what I mean. It didn't seem...
Yeah.
Like there was a solid plan or vision. But still, decent comic. I'm just curious if they're oversaturating the number of Hulk titles that are out there, and I think they are.
Now, if you have not read Hulk Gray number 1, it's a really good comic. I mean, I like Hulk Gray. I mean, it's Jeff Loeb and Tim Sale. It was a perfectly great story, and I loved it when it was first out years ago. So, I mean... If you never got that series, then that's another 22 pages in this package that's new to you. And that's actually a good story. So someone who's never gotten Hulk Gray number 1, I think will get a little more value out of this particular package.
So anything else? Does that pretty much wrap it up?
I think that does it.
Cool.
Join us next week for our All Last Issues episode with Blackest Night Tales of the Core number 3 from DC, Ultimatum number 5 from Marvel, and Fear Agent number 27 from Dark Horse.
The show notes and forum for this podcast can be found at www.comicbookpage.com under the podcast and forum sections of the website. Please email us at theguys@comicbookpage.com and let us know what you think of what was discussed in this episode. Thanks for listening.